Here is your Radio Theater Channel weekly podcast for download. The RTC still has the very best old-time radio on the live streaming. And if it's music you love, tune in to the RTC Music Channel, where this link and many others are on our website at oldtimeradiolisten.com. Now, here's Jim.
Welcome, everybody. I'm Jim Dolan, your host. Well, we're here for detectives this time, and we're going to hear from Philip Marlowe, that tough-as-nails private eye, about the Mexican boat ride. And that's going to be from 7:30 of 49. And in about 30 minutes' time, we're going to hear a more current detective, yours truly, Johnny Dollar. This is all about the JPD matter, and it's from 1957. Without further ado, here's Philip Marlowe.
Get this and get it straight. Crime is a sucker's road, and those who travel it wind up in the gutter of the prison of the grave. This time I took a beating and gave one. The man who lived in the dock was afraid. Someone I never got to meet was murdered, and a knife-wielding crab was destroyed. All because a girl who hated the water took a boat ride in old Mexico.
From the pen of Raymond Chandler, outstanding author of mystery, comes his most famous character and crime's most deadly enemy as we present The Adventures of Philip Marlowe. Now, with Gerald Moore, starred as Philip Marlowe, we bring you tonight's story, Mexican Boat Ride.
It was a rare morning, clear and clean. You know the kind that knocks 10 years off your age and makes you taste the sunshine and your orange juice? It was a day to be spent on an open road to someplace new and exciting. But a phone call I'd received had reduced my open road to Carmelita Avenue and nothing more exciting than Beverly Hills. The house I stopped at was one of those you entered through a tunnel of dank, overhanging foliage on a flagstone path grown green with damp moss. A low, thick-walled affair with tiny barred windows hidden from the sidewalk. I pressed the bell, and a moment later a sallow housekeeper opened the door with what seemed to be a last ounce of strength. She squinted at my card and beckoned me inside. I followed her down a dusky corridor to a heavy closed door where she signaled me to wait. The air in the house smelled thick and stale. When she came out again, she held the door open for me and motioned me into a room full of darkness. It became nearly complete when the door clicked shut behind me. All I could see was the vague form of a man in smoked glasses propped up on a bed across the room.
There's a chair beside you, Marlowe, if you care to sit.
Oh, thanks.
I'm Carl Estabrook, importer. You may have heard of me.
No, I don't think so.
Well, no matter. Marlowe, I have a peculiar problem. I want to know why my wife, Ona, was on a boat day before yesterday off the coast of Mexico. Think you could find out?
Well, if that's all you got to go on, I doubt it.
No, there's a little more.
Huh?
Ona and I planned to take vacation together. But when I was confined with this illness, we decided she should go on alone.
Oh, then your illness is the reason for the midsummer blackout, huh?
Yes. If I expose my eyes to light at any time in the next few weeks, the doctors promised me plenty of pain and virtual blindness.
Oh.
It's temporary, but tedious to mend. That's why I need a capable man with sharp eyes.
To look into what, specifically?
The paradox of my wife aboard a boat.
Mm-hmm.
She has a phobia about them. The mere thought of being on a boat makes her panicky. She drove to Ensenada, Mexico, earlier this week, but believe me, her plans did not include boat rides.
Well, tell me, how'd you find out she was on one? Did she write?
No, she hasn't written me at all, but that's not unusual for her. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine got back yesterday from a fishing trip down there. The day before, his boat passed another with a girl aboard. He got a good look at her. He was so sure that it was Ona that he hailed her. The girl turned and ran inside. It bothered him to the extent that when he got home here, he called me to find out if Ona was in Ensenada.
Is that all?
And that's all. He didn't get the name of the boat.
Look, you want me to go all the way down there just to find out if the girl he saw was Mrs. Estabrook?
Right. What is your fee, Marlowe?
$50 a day plus expenses. That's the minimum if I take the job. I don't think I will. When business gets so bad I have to do divorce work, I'll quit and write my memoirs. No, I'm sorry, but that's the way it is.
No, sit down, Marlowe. Ona and I have had our share of difficulties, true. She's quite a few years younger than I and used to be a dancer. But, generally speaking, we're happy.
Specifically what?
I'm worried about her. Here, there's money in this envelope and a recent photograph of my wife. And there's more of both if the need arises. Incidentally, what kind of a day is it outside?
Gorgeous.
Well, then you can drive. It's only 250 miles.
Yeah. By the way, how has the importing business been lately, legitimately speaking?
You do have a suspicious mind, don't you?
Only when the situation calls for it, and this does. However, I can understand an imagination working overtime here in the dark, Mr. Estabrook. So I'll take your money and go on down to Ensenada and see if anything's wrong. But look, I'm giving you notice beforehand. If it turns out to be family laundry and nothing more, I drop it.
You're a reputable man. Just see that I get my money's worth, Marlowe, and you can keep the change. I'll expect to hear from you.
When my eyes adjusted to the dazzling glare outside, I looked in the envelope and picture of an impish, dark-haired woman and five $100 bills. For the first time, I realized what Estabrook had meant by keep the change. But it didn't help my attitude even a little. By 2 o'clock, I was on the road south. A late lunch in La Jolla with an old friend, a routine baggage inspection at the border, and then 70 twisting miles of lonely road brought me to Ensenada, just as the Mexican sun dropped into the sea. I drove past the piers and canneries at the edge of town, and then along the curving shore to the only hotel elegant enough to meet the demands of the woman I figured Ona Estabrook to be. After I'd gotten a room and cleaned up, I went to the desk and asked for her. She was registered, had number 74, and at the moment was out on the patio. All of which sounded ridiculously normal. And I thought again of an imagination at work in a dark room back in L.A. I thanked the clerk in crippled Spanish and turned in time to catch the end of a long, cold stare from a pair of frog-like eyes that bulged out of an otherwise handsome head on a man in a gray gabardine suit. I didn't think my language had been that bad. But when Popeye followed me out onto the patio, I wasn't too sure. There was no mistaking Ona Estabrook. She sat alone at a table in the far corner, a tall, minted gin drink in front of her. So I put on my best tourist-type smile and walked over. Well, Ona Estabrook, this is a pleasure. Enjoying your visit?
Why, yes, very much, but I don't think I...
Know me? Oh, of course, you wouldn't remember. My name's Marlowe, Philip Marlowe.
No, I'm sorry, Mr. Marlowe, but
you were a dancer, weren't you? Before your marriage, I mean?
Well, yes, I was a dancer, but you'll have to excuse me now. I'm expecting a friend. I hope you don't mind.
Oh, well, just one thing then, Mrs. Estabrook. Would you mind telling me why you were out on a boat day before yesterday?
A boat?
Mm-hmm.
Why do you ask that?
Because you hate boats. You have a phobia about them. And yet you were seen aboard one just 2 days ago. How come?
Well, how clumsy of me. I've spilled a drink all over my skirt. Excuse me. I'll have to change.
That maneuver was as subtle as a bulldozer at work. When she spilled her drink, it was done desperately, and fear sent her running for the exit. I turned to follow her as she left the lighted patio and headed down a dark arcade. But a gray gabardine suit and a pair of Popeyes slid out of a chair and beat me to it. I waited until their footsteps faded, which said they turned a corner. Then I started after them. It was strictly follow the leader, but I didn't realize how many were playing the game until a knife point stung at the skin at the soft part of the back about kidney high.
Stop, senor, and don't cry out. Don't even say ouch.
I turned and saw a mottled red face, ugly on a squat, long-armed body. The ivory-handled knife in his hand could have clipped my spine in one easy thrust.
You got a car here, senor? Come on, I speak English good. You got a car?
Yeah, I got a car. What's it to you?
I am Jaiba, the crab. It's lots to me.
What's your pitch, Buster? Come on, tell me.
Martinez says for me to keep a sharp eye on things to be sure something is not wrong. It looks to me like something is wrong with you, senor.
Who's Martinez?
You going to play possum, senor? This one is your car, huh?
All right. Yeah.
Okay. I take first your one. Now, please to get in. You gonna drive.
Believe it or not, you're making a big mistake, Krabby. Besides, what if I don't want to drive?
Oh, you better want to drive, gringo. Or I kill you right here. Go on, drive. Andale! See, stop here. And now we get out. It's nice and quiet here on the beach, no? Walk over there to that old adobe wall. We're gonna have a talk there.
It's gonna be dull, Buster. We've got nothing in common.
Please, senor, don't make it hard on me. I don't know why you gotta come and mix everything up again when time is running out. Why did you come?
I needed new huaraches.
Look, senor, you think I'm ugly?
You're no beauty crab, let's face it.
See, and I can act even uglier. Maybe I could go on the radio and make a big hit, no? Or maybe I make the big hit on your face.
Oh!
Don't try something, senor. Or I kill you with your own gun. Now, the truth. You spoke to the senor about the boat. Why?
I forget.
Who are you, senor?
Private detective named Marlowe.
Oh, a private detective. Who are you working for? Dolph Bentley?
I never heard of Dolph Bentley. Who's he?
You're lying. The senora knows him. I heard her say Dolph Bentley won't make it tonight.
Yeah, he's lucky.
See, I tell you something else. He better not make it. Martinez is going to do business with one man only tonight. Now, you want to say something? No? Then I'll say it. You take what's going to be left of your face back to Senor Bentley until you get out of Ensenada and don't come back. Understand?
Wait a minute.
Come on, wake up.
Hey, stop the crab.
Come on.
Who are you? It's you. I'll kill you.
Take it easy, will you? You're in good hands now, Marlowe. I'm a fellow American. You know, you're pretty lucky, you know that?
I am? Oh, sure, yeah. Let my pal go.
Him? Oh, I chased him off. You know, it's a wonder he didn't put a knife in you. These fellas are mean with knives.
This guy was no slouch with a gun butt, either. Hey, where'd you come from, anyway?
Oh, down the beach a ways. I just finished working on my boat, and I was taking a walk, and I heard the commotion, came over to see about it. This guy was beating you up, so I yelled and started for him, but he ran.
Oh, is that right? I'm glad somebody stopped him. Thanks very much, Mr.
Roman. Lou Roman's my name. Yeah, I'm pleased to meet you, Marlowe.
Thanks. You know me?
Well, yes, I took the liberty of looking in your wallet to see that devil had robbed you.
Oh.
It doesn't seem so, though. Yeah, I guess I got here just in time. You're a private investigator, I see. You working on a case now?
It's debatable. So far, the case is working on me. I'd like to find a guy named Dolph Bentley, though.
Dolph Bentley?
Yeah. Guy who beat me up had the idea that I was... I was hired by Dolph Bentley. Did you ever hear of him?
No. No, and I come down here every year to fish, too.
Uh-huh.
Know a lot of folks around here, but I never heard of that one before. Why are you after him?
Well, he's tied up in some way to the crab, who seems to work with another guy named Martinez, who, in turn, is going to do some business of some kind tonight with somebody other than Dolph Bentley. I don't know. And it's all connected, for some screwy reason, with a woman who took a boat ride the day before yesterday.
Well, what about that? The woman being on a boat, I mean.
Oh, well, she can't stand boats. She's afraid
of... Oh, my head. Oh,
no, wait. Here.
Thanks.
I better get you some first aid away.
That's a good idea. Holy smoke, my car.
Man, I'll relax. Huh? Relax. It's right over there. Come on. Let me help you up.
All right.
Easy now. That's it now. I'll drive you. Where are you staying? At the hotel, huh?
Yeah. Thanks, good. Roman. I'm still dizzy.
Easy. I got you.
I got to get back there. I got to find that girl, because she's up to her hair doing a very nasty mess.
Listen, Marlowe.
Huh?
If I can help in any way, let me know, will you? You know, us Americans have to stick together in a place like this, right? That's it. Come on, let's go.
Oh. Easy now. Lou Roman, a hail fellow, was indeed well met. He found my gun and drove me back to the hotel. A long hour had gone by since Ona Estabrook had run from the patio, followed by the pop-eyed character in the gabardine suit. I tried her room, checked with the desk again, and from there spent 30 minutes peering into corners and balconies and getting nothing but indignant glares from Mexican lovers.
Senor, please,
so I left the building and started through the grounds. I worked my way from the stables up into a secluded garden deserted by all but a marble statue of Montezuma, who, when I passed him, groaned. In the dock at my feet lay Haiba the crab, his mottled face twisted into a tortured grin of agony. And sticking straight up just above his belt buckle was the white ivory handle of his own knife. Crab! Crab, who was it? Who got you?
Oh, senor,
I am sorry what I did.
Never mind that. Who did this, do you know?
Dolph Bentley.
Now get a doctor.
No, yo, senor. I tell Martinez that Dolph Bentley is...
Crab. Yeah.
In just a moment, the second act of Philip Marlowe. But first, when you're 65, if you have worked in business or industry, call any office of the Social Security Administration for information about your old age and survivor's insurance. The account number that appears on the Social Security card identifies your wage account. The amount of retirement and family insurance that may be payable is set by this account. Now with our star, Gerald Moore, we return to the second act of Philip Marlowe and tonight's story, The Mexican Boat Ride.
Even as the life trickled out of the ugly little man called Aiba, and his face, which had been knotted tight in pain, went slowly limp and he was still, I knew that I'd have to get next to Dolph Bentley before the importance of owner Estabrook aboard a fishing boat off Ensenada would make any sense. Also, I knew that there was a good chance that said Mr. Bentley and the gentleman in gray gabardine, known to me as Popeyes, were one and the same. So I started back for the hotel. But halfway there, I stopped at the sight of a figure ahead, scampering toward an all-alone taxi parked near the main entrance. It was owner Estabrook. I took off after her. When she was in the cab and away before I could get close enough to do any good, I tried the next best thing, which was the sombrero doorman nearby, who I figured might have heard the address she'd given the driver. Yeah, but what I didn't figure was that the doorman might not habla much English.
The Senora Estabrook. Si, senor. Her enters libre a minute ago.
Yeah, that's right. I know that. Now, look, where did her go? Which way in the libre?
Libre. Uh-huh. Oh, un momento, senor. Libre!
Oh, no. No.
Viene, senor. No, coming
look.
Pronto.
Amigo, I don't want a taxi. No libre.
No libre.
None whatsoever. Now, please, come here. Let's back it up a little, huh? Senora Estabrook in libre, right?
Si, senor.
Okay. Now, where did she go? What direction? Que dirección?
Oh, ahora comprendo. Uh-huh. The senora.
The senora. Que dirección? Comprendo?
Si, senor. Senora Estabrook go to the pier, the fishing's pier.
Which one? Which fishing's pier? Qual pier?
The small pier, senor. The little one near the big cannery. The fish's cannery,
that's
senor.
All I want to know. Gracias, amigo, and... Uh-oh.
Senor? Senor, what are you seeing?
I'm not sure. But even if I were, I wouldn't be able to explain it to you. Buenas noches, pal. Thanks a lot. I had been seeing at the silhouette of a man huddled close to the ground and slinking out from a hotel along a high hedge that led back toward the statue and the body of Aiba, a man who I knew could be the elusive Popeyes. I followed the walk that was close into the hotel until I was on a line with the hedge. Then I started after him fast. I still had a good 2 yards to go when he heard me and pivoted, so I swung first!
Oh! Why, you dirty...
Roman, wait a minute, hold it. Gee, it's me, Marlowe, I'm sorry. Oh. Holy smoke, I thought you were someone else.
Oh, gargantua, maybe? Oh, brother.
Oh, I'm sorry.
What'd you hit me with,
Marlowe? Everything I had. I figured you were Dolph Bentley and such, Roman. I didn't want you to get away with murder, literally.
Murder? Hey, not that girl you mentioned, Marlowe.
Ona Estabrook? Uh-huh. No. The corpse is that item you sigged away from me over in those ruins. Somebody got to him with his own knife there near the statue.
Uh-huh, then I was right. I did see someone move over
what?
Near there. Well, yeah, a couple of minutes ago, Marlowe. I was on the balcony outside of my room. It faces the garden here, you see. And when I saw you run for the main entrance, I had a feeling that you might be in trouble again, so I came on down here.
Well, then what happened?
Well, I was about to call out to you when I heard some noise over there near the statue. It was a man. He was running away fast, heading toward those stables. A man wearing gabardine, maybe tan, maybe gray.
Maybe Dolph Bentley. Thanks, Roman. You've been a big help. When you get back to the hotel, tell him about the dead man, will you? I gotta run. Stable was a robust left field as pegged to home plate from where we'd been standing. So by the time I got there, I was out of breath and facing nothing more important than thick darkness, a lot of hay, and a couple of horses who couldn't sleep nights talking things over. Until I moved around a corner past the stalls and close to the half-open door of a shack. marked both cabina telefono and the equivalent in English that showed a single unshaded light. And under that, a man standing alone next to a telephone, writing something on the back of an envelope. He was wearing a gray gabardine suit, and when he lifted his Popeyes from the paper in front of him, I knew the next move had to be mine, 38 and all. Let it go, Buster. Yeah. Keep your hands close to your sides.
Just as you say, senor. I'd be a fool not to obey you.
You're so right, a dead fool. So keep that in mind while we chat, won't you, Mr. Bentley?
Bentley?
Uh-huh.
How did you find out who I am?
It was easy. All I had to do was listen to a dying man's last two words when I asked him to name his murderer. He said, Dolph Bentley. Any comment?
Yes. You know a lot, senor.
Don't resent it, friend. I learned it all the hard way. Don't move, Bentley.
I was only changing my position, senor.
Which will be prone if you try it again. Now, what do you know about this whole mess and an American girl named Ona Estabrook, who I figure is no mobster?
Nothing, senor.
You're a liar, Bentley. Which brings me to the point. One, why the pressure on the girl, and two, what's so important about her taking a ride on a fishing boat? Come on, brother, it's getting late for a murderer. Start talking straight the first time out.
All right. I'll start with a question. Senor, how does all this concern you? You gain a percentage if the smugglers are not interfered with, perhaps?
We were talking about the girl, remember?
Yes, I remember. But you see, senor, I have little to offer on that score.
How little?
A single observation. In your country, senor, people who do not mind their own business are called nosy. Here in Mexico, we have another term. Asno.
Which means what?
Jackass, senor. Who, unlike the cat, cannot see in the dark.
But can try his best, Bentley.
No gun, senor.
Okay, amigo, no gun, but this. Asno. When Bentley met the floor and went out cold, I sagged to one knee. Stayed that way until the air rushing into my lungs quit sounding like sandpaper over a drumhead. Then I got back to my feet and turned on a bracket lamp on the other side of the room. I opened Bentley's jacket, slipped his .32 automatic out of its shoulder holster, emptied the clip, and stopped dead at the shimmer of light dancing on polished silver that I hadn't expected. It was a badge. Below his shoulder holster and pinned to his vest, Republic of Mexico, Department of Customs, Captain! I made a dive for the envelope near the telephone. On the back there was writing in thick pencil, which I finally figured to mean fishing pier near cannery, 2 a.m. Inside, nothing. On the front, further proof that I'd never met Mr. Dolph Bentley at all, but instead it tangled hard-like with one Captain Juan Descartes, Intelligence Section, Custom Building, Mexico City, Mexico. While trying to revive Captain Descartes, the truth rammed into my mind. Ona Estabrook had rushed off for the pier near the cannery that Captain Descartes had noted as a good place to be at 2 o'clock in the morning, which was less than 20 minutes away, and a great time for me to get to my car and the pier.
It won't work, senor.
You're a bright boy, thanks.
Well, do you like the job on the car, senor? I think it shines well for the 8 pesos you owe me.
Nobody asked you to bother, Junior, but I'll see you later. Right now, I gotta run, huh?
For 8 pesos, $1 you can ride, senor. I'll replace the distributor cap.
What? Come here, you...
But, senor, it was very dirty all over, inside, too. The steering wheel, black as can be. Look, I ruined my best rag cleaning
it. That's tough. Now, give me that distributor cap, or you'll be the saddest pair of dark eyes between here and the Panama Canal.
Senor!
Oh, never mind. Here.
You pay me the dollar?
Yeah. Just put the cap back where it belongs. Quick, will you? I'm in a hurry. Well, come on, let's go! The precious 60 seconds ticked off before I was out of the parking lot and driving fast toward the fishing pier near the cannery, where I knew I was finally going to get next to Dolph Bentley and, if I made it in time, prevent another murder. When I screeched to a stop away from the pier, piled out of my car and ran the length of the oil-soaked planking to where a single boat was making ready to cast off, I saw one of the two persons aboard the small catch was Ona Estabrook. The other was Lou Roman, hearty American fisherman. When I stepped aboard, our hunch hit me right between the eyes. I pulled my gun and pointed it an inch above his waist.
What are you doing here, Marlo?
I might ask you the same question, Roman, or do I call you Bentley from here on out?
Marlo, you know. Now he can't kill me. Now I don't have to be afraid of him anymore. Oh, Marlo, thank goodness you got here in time.
Yeah, hooray. The Marines have landed in the form of a private
island. Cut it out, Bentley, and don't move. Oh, no, what do you mean about being afraid? What's your connection with this fisherman here?
Well, it was an accident, Marlowe. A mix-up in our baggage. Lou Roman and I both happened to stop for customs inspection at the border at the same time, and our suitcases were switched. I didn't notice it at the time, but when I got to the hotel, I discovered the mistake and went to Roman's room to correct it.
But instead, you found Bentley here posing as Roman, right?
Yes. He killed him, Marlowe. He told me he did.
That's a dirty lie. Roman's all right. He's in Chicago.
No, he's not. He's dead. You killed him. Someplace between here and Tijuana, Marlowe. He said I'd get the same treatment if I opened my mouth.
Then he's the one who forced you to go out on that boat yesterday. Well, stay back, Bentley.
Yes. So that people wouldn't be suspicious, he made me appear at the hotel, in the patio there, at the restaurant.
Well, why didn't you run?
Well, I couldn't. He wasn't around. Another man was. A horrible man with large eyes that never left me.
Yeah. So why don't you drop it, Marlowe?
No sale, Bentley. You see, I know that the horrible man with the large eyes can't be one of your henchmen. His badge says so.
What?
Badge? He's an officer, Marlowe?
Yeah, captain owner. Give up, Bentley?
You had better. There are too many men ready to take you.
Descartes. Where'd you come from?
Oh, I have been here quite a while. But your story was so interesting, I just couldn't interrupt.
When Marlowe took you for Dolph Bentley, Captain Descartes, you played along because you didn't know who he was, is that it?
Yes, Senora, and I did not find out until I heard Bentley call Marlowe a private eye.
You're not mad at me, Captain, huh? Even though I bungled your plan to capture Martinez? And not to mention our little meeting at the stables.
Oh, senor, do not say that you bungled the job of catching Martinez. It was more a matter of priority. Por favor, senora, the tacos.
Of course, here you are.
Gracias. You see, Senor Marlowe, I am certain that one day I will catch Martinez. But not at the cost of letting a murderer kill again. But, Senor Marlowe, there is one thing that puzzles me. The murder of the one known as Jaiba.
Oh, Martinez henchman. Well, you see, Captain, he knew that a man named Dolph Bentley was mixed up in this because he'd overheard Ona and her keeper, then called Lou Roman, talking about him. He wanted to know more. Also, he couldn't figure who I was.
So he beat you up?
Correct. Bentley, of course, only saved my life because it was an easy way to find out just how much Jaiba did know, after which he got to him. Enough?
Not quite, senor. There is still one thing. How did you know that Lou Roman was actually Bentley?
On a hunch, Captain. And by positive identification from you, Ono, when we were on the boat. But now it's my turn. I got a question for you, honey. Have you had enough vacation?
Uh-huh. As a matter of fact, Marlowe, I wired my husband just before we came in to eat.
Oh.
I said the change did me a world of good. Be home tomorrow to stay. Love, always. Well, Captain, will you pass the tacos, please? They're awfully good, really.
It was late the next afternoon, and Ona Estabrook was already gone when I checked out of the hotel, said goodbye to Captain Descartes, and headed north for the border, where 2 hours later I stopped for customs inspection of my baggage. It was dark, and I was only 50 miles from Los Angeles before I realized exactly what that inspection had meant, because it was then, for the first time, that I noticed the little cowhide suitcase on the seat next to me, which should have been mine, was tagged differently. The name and address of a man who lived in Long Beach, California. I got there, I kept driving. I knew I could ship it to him and ask for mine in exchange when I got home. Oh, yes. I'd had just about enough for a while.
The Adventures of Philip Marlowe, bringing you Raymond Chandler's most famous character and crime's most deadly enemy, star Gerald Moore, and are produced and directed by Norman MacDonald. Script is by Mel Donnelly, Robert Mitchell, and Gene Levitt. Featured in the cast were Mary Shipp, Harry Bartell, Nestor Paiva, Bill Boucher, Ralph Moody, Bill Shaw, and Jerry Farber. The special music is written by Richard Arant. Be sure and be with us next week when Philip Marlowe says...
It started with death on my doorstep and got worse when I lied to a sympathetic bull, was pistol-whipped by a gorilla with dimples and fought with a kitten on the keys. And it might have gone on that way all night if I hadn't been helped by the king of the beasts.
Shh. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Next, the life and loves of Linda Lovelace, girl intern. For the many fans who wait for her on the radio, we present once again the interesting story, The Life and Loves of Linda Lovelace, Girl Intern. Written for radio by Ole O'Leahy, it stars Marcia Van Allshot as Linda, Sherman Al Sturdley as David, with Hugo L. Summerstopper as Uncle Eugene, and Webley L. Webster as Ricky L. Llewellyn. Yesterday, David returned from his first day's work at the Teddy Tinker Peanut Butter Factory in River's Mouth to tell Ricky Llewellyn there was another position open and to see if he wanted the job. And it's later the same evening now as our friends sit round the fire in the
earth. Well, what kind of a job would it be, Dave?
Well, I don't know, Ricky. I imagine somewhere along the production line somewhere.
Well, would it be in the same division that you're in? I mean, the shell cracking?
In cracking? It may be there, yes. Or it might be in packing. Or some other of the many departments.
I don't know. It's been so long since I worked there.
I think the mother of you would be very proud if you were bringing home a paycheck, Ricky.
Well, we're pretty well loaded that way.
How old are you, anyway?
Well, that's something I had never thought of either, Ricky.
Well, I think that's somebody's own private business. I don't think...
Well, I know, but...
How old are you, you old gaffer?
For me?
Yeah.
Well, I don't see what that has to do with it.
I don't think that you should ask those questions.
How old are you anyway, Uncle Eugene? It's a good question.
I just wanted to know about
Ricky because he'd never seen the work or anything.
I've never worked. We got a lot of money.
Well, I never worked either.
I know, but...
A few weeks at the Peanut Butter Factory when I came down with peanut fever.
Well, you were, weren't you, foreign correspondent for Drug Weekly magazine?
No.
I read that.
I was on safari for several years there when I got lost in Africa.
How long were you lost that time, Dave?
7 years, it was.
What were you doing over there, anyway?
I was in search of Edward Merchley.
You know, you got some of the peanut butter right there on that upholstered... Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
I wish you would be careful, David.
Boy, this place is going to be a mess if you stick that job out at the factory.
Well, if you don't start, you know, trying to scrape it off before you come home.
Well, that probably is the easiest. They didn't tell me anything about that when I took the job. They just told me how to crack the peanuts.
Look, why don't we leave it this way, Dave, boy? You find out just what the job is, and I'll make up my mind.
All right. We'd like to have you aboard.
Love to.
And so our friends chat pleasantly into the night as a cool breeze blows off the lake over River's Mouth. Be sure and join us tomorrow when we'll hear Linda say...
How old are you, David?
That's tomorrow in the next exciting episode in the life and loves of Linda Lovely, Word Carr speaking.
From Hollywood, it's time now for... Johnny Dollar.
George Reed here, Johnny.
Uh-oh. What fantastic character is Floyd's of England insured this time?
Now, what is that supposed to mean?
More singing mice, wayward cats, and how about the counterfeit money problem?
Johnny...
No, let me guess.
Johnny, if you'll just listen to me...
I got it. You're in trouble because you've done a switch. You've insured somebody against living instead of the other way around, that it?
Of course not. No, I must admit we do have one policy of that sort and effect.
There, I knew it.
However, that is not the one I called you about.
Okay, George, what is?
We've issued a policy. Well, I guess it is a little unusual at that.
I fear the worst, but go on.
Well, it's on a small brewery over near...
Brewery? You mean a beer factory?
That's right. It's over near the town of Tamaqua, Pennsylvania.
Oh, yeah, I know that country pretty well.
Good. We've insured the Dortmund Brewery against possible damage from a nearby construction project.
Well, you said unusual. What's so unusual about that?
Perhaps you'd better come over here and let me tell you.
Yeah. When you say it that way, I guess I'd better.
Bob Bailey in the exciting adventures of a man with the action-packed expense account. America's fabulous freelance insurance investigator.
Yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
And now, Act One of Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar.
Expense account submitted by Special Investigator Johnny Dollar to Floyd's of England, North American Office, Hartford, Connecticut. Following is an account of expenses incurred during my investigation of the JPD matter. Expense account item one, $1.10, taxi from my apartment to George Reed's office, where he promptly dragged me over to a large map tacked to one of the walls.
Here it is, Johnny, between the towns of Tamaqua and Trackville, Pennsylvania, on a little river that's called Pinxsutawney Creek. Old Indian name, I believe.
Uh-huh.
The Dorkman Brewery is just about here.
Yeah. Well, okay, I'll rent a car in New York and drive over there.
Now, wait. By making a couple of train changes, you can get most of the way over there by rail.
Anything to save the company a buck, is that it?
Why not? When that freewheeling expense account of yours gets into operation...
Okay, okay. What's the face value of the policy?
Coverage for the whole plant, $820,000.
Wow-wee. So I'll rent a car in New York.
All right, all right. Now, as I told you, we've insured the Dorkman Brewery against possible damage from the building of a plant right next to it.
What kind of a plant?
Competition. Another brewery.
Oh, I see. Possible malicious damage. Is that what they're thinking of?
That's what J.P. seems to be worried about.
J.P.?
J.P. Dorkman. Owner, manager, president, brewmeister, and anything else you can think of.
Has anything happened yet?
No, but I want you to go there and be sure that nothing does.
Is this J.P. my contact?
Yes.
Okay, George, I'm on my way. Expense account item 2935, fare and incidentals, Hartford to New York. Item 3, $50, deposit on a drive-your-own car. Item 4, 50 cents, toll through the Holland Tunnel. I cut straight across the top of Jersey, crossed the Delaware at Phillipsburg, and finally pulled into the little town of Tamaqua shortly after 6 p.m. Items 5, 6, and 7, 1220. For dinner, a place to rest my weary head, and breakfast the next morning. The Dorkman Brewery sat on the western bank of Pinxsutawney Creek, about 5 miles out of town, and looked as though it had been sitting there for 1,000 years. It was a small affair, and the old frame buildings were badly in need of a coat of paint. Just north of it rose a towering cliff, and on top of that cliff stood an array of cranes and machines and bulldozers that are used on modern large-scale construction jobs. I parked my car at the entrance of the office building and was greeted at the door by a large, raw-boned woman of about 50 with straggly yellow hair and wearing a faded blue cotton dress that looked as though it hadn't been ironed in years.
Something I can do for you?
Oh, why, I'm looking for Mr. J.P. Dorkman.
Mister? That's a laugh.
Is it? Why?
Because I'm J.P.
What?
That's right. Anything wrong with it?
Well, I...
Hey, wait a minute. You, another of those lawyers from that job up on the cliff, come to fancy talk me about
no.
not having to worry in the world about what they're doing to
no,
me up there.
No,
and how I better mind my own business. What do you mean, no?
My name is Dollar, Johnny Dollar. I'm here on behalf of Floyd's of England.
The insurance company? Well, now that's different. You come on into my private office, Johnny.
Her private office was furnished with a battered walnut desk, some ancient filing cabinets, and a couple of straight wooden chairs, nothing else. Hardly the kind of an office you'd expect for the president of a company worth $820,000.
There's nothing fancy about it, Johnny, because there's nothing fancy about any part of my brewery. But that isn't what counts. We've been here ever since my great-great-grandfather built it up, and all we've cared about is making the finest beer in the country. Gretchen, and we do make it, too. Gretchen, can't you hear me out?
Yes, indeed.
Gretchen, I want you to bring Mr. Dollar a pitcher full and a glass.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, look, I'm afraid I'm not much of a beer
you
man.
You will be when you've tasted this. It's the creek that does it, you know, Pinxsutawney Creek. Finest water for beer in the whole United States. That's what makes good beer, you know.
Yes, so I've heard.
That's why that dirty Clarkson Kemper bunch are building up on the cliff to get at that water.
I understand they'll be your competitors.
Ha! All their fancy modern equipment and methods can't produce the brew the way I can. The long, slow, easy way. With all the good old-fashioned apparatus. The old country method.
Yes, I see.
By Johnny, we make our own barley malt. And we grind it by hand. And we come up with a wort that's second to none in the world. The old-type sparger, too. And the hop jack. and the finest strain of yeast there is.
Yes, I'm sure that
3-4 months we age before we rack a drop. Sure, we take more time and more trouble, but we come up with a better brew, better than any modern plant can ever make.
Well, then what's your problem?
They're getting ready to blast up on that cliff.
Blast?
A whole big chunk of it away. And when they do, that whole thing will come crashing down here. Thousands of tons of rock.
Well, surely there's some state authority or something to prevent that.
Oh, they bamboozled the authorities. And your insurance company, too. They'll say it was an accident, a miscalculation. And when that rock comes crashing down here, it'll wreck this whole plant of mine.
Well, you do have insurance, remember?
It'll wreck all my fine old equipment that can never again be replaced, because there are no such things anymore.
Well, when's all this blasting supposed to take place?
Who knows? Tonight, tomorrow, next week, who knows?
That soon?
Yeah. So, Johnny, if there's anything you can do, you'd better do it now. What's insurance money if I have to lose this for it?
Who knows? Maybe she was right, suspecting her rivals might try a stunt like that to put her out of business. But it all seemed a little too far-fetched. And yet, when I think of some of the unscrupulous things that have been done to put down competition, maybe she was justified in suspecting this Carlson Kemper crowd of... Yeah, maybe she was.
Act two of yours truly, Johnny Dollar, in a moment.
Our flag now numbers 50 stars, and behind each star there stands yet another flag representing one of the 50 states. Massachusetts state flag, bearing a green pine tree, is the descendant of the famous Liberty Tree flag that came out of Boston to serve all the original 13 colonies. It was under the Liberty Tree flag that the Sons of Liberty met and planned the Boston Tea Party, that our floating batteries on the Delaware River defended Philadelphia, and on the Charles River defied Howe's cannons. Beneath the tree is inscribed the state motto, En supetit placidum sub libertate quietum. By the sword we seek peace, but peace only under liberty. These words were originally written by the famous English patriot Algernon Sidney about 1659. This was a message intended for King George III. Unhappily, it went unheeded. Massachusetts state flag, the flag of the sixth state to enter the Union, was adopted on March 18, 1904.
And now, Act Two of yours truly, Johnny Dollar and the J.P.D. Matter.
If J.P. Dorfman was right, if there was the least possibility she was right in her suspicion that Carlson Kemper would blast thousands of tons of rock down on a little plant in order to put her out of business, well, there was only one thing to do. I got back into my car and drove by a roundabout way up to the top of the cliff overlooking the Dorfman Brewery. There in the middle of the vast array of heavy construction equipment, giant cranes, trucks, huge cement mixers, and so on, I found the main construction shack. And by a stroke of luck, one of the partners in the proposed new brewery, Mr. James Carlson.
Ah, that crazy old lady's being absurd, Mr. Dollar. You really want the truth? Well, I think she'd welcome our smashing that antiquated brewery of hers out of existence.
Is that what you plan to do, Mr. Carlson?
Can you be serious? By blasting a few tons of rock off the face of the cliff into the river?
Or a few thousand tons?
Or a few thousand tons. Won't do that place of hers a bit of harm.
You're sure?
Of course I'm sure. Only thing I'm not sure of is why she stays in business.
What do you mean by that?
Well, she can't be making any money. Methods she uses were out of date in this country 50 years ago. The product's good, sure. But today, you've got Snowball. Did you know, Dollar, that out of the goodness of my heart, I offer to take that crummy plant of hers off her hands?
Or because her location is better, down next to the water supply.
Oh, partly, sure. I offered her nearly $500,000 for her spot. $400,000, to be exact. But no dice. She just kept bothering us, trying to get out a lot of injunctions against our building there.
I assume you have the necessary permits for this blasting operation.
Whole draw full of them. Hey, look at them yourself. At the same time, appreciate the volume of red tape necessary to do anything these days.
But suppose that something should go wrong. That, quite by accident, the top of that cliff should drop down on J.P.'s brewery.
Mr. Dollar, it's to obviate any such possibility that I called in one of the foremost blasters in the country, who, purely incidentally, is top man for one of the biggest makers of explosives in the world. You talk to him, Mr. Dollar.
Maybe I will.
Believe me, I can understand why you might not take my word for the safety of the operation we're about to undertake, but certainly you can't question his word.
You say about to undertake. When?
I believe he's planned the big blow-off for tonight.
Tonight?
Yeah, come on, I'll take you to him.
We found this expert, a Mr. Sidney Crutchfield, in a small, tidy shack set out near the edge of the cliff, working over a series of complicated diagrams with a busy slide rule in his hand. And I must confess, he turned out to be one of the most interesting men I've ever met. Tall, slim, and gray-haired, he had a quiet, easy, yet confident manner that completely belied his hazardous occupation. This was the man who had done the dynamiting for some of the biggest jobs in this country, had moved mountains and rivers in the construction of huge dams, had blasted the way for some of our vast highway networks.
As you can see by the dates on these sheets, I finished planning this blast over 2 weeks ago. But I find that constant checking and rechecking never does any harm.
Mr. Carlson tells me you plan to set off this blast tonight.
Yes. Actually, I shall push the plunger at exactly 2 o'clock tomorrow morning. If Mr. Carlson is ready.
Don't you worry about it, Mr. Crutchfield. We're moving the equipment and the shacks away right now.
Excellent. And at the time of the blast, no one is to be here but me.
That's what your contract says.
And that's the way it must be.
For safety, Mr. Crutchfield?
Well, call it a fetish of mine.
Uh-huh. And there'll be no damage to the brewery plant down below?
I'll stake my reputation on it. Come, Mr. Dollar. If you like, I'll show you how I've made the sets for this blast.
We spent the rest of the day inspecting every tunnel, shaft, and drill hole into which the explosives had been packed and fused. And the artistry of this man was evident from the word go. By 6 p.m., all the machines and shacks and equipment had been moved back from the edge of the cliff that was to be blown off. The place was deserted, except for Mr. Crutchfield and me.
And now, you must get into your car and leave, Mr. Dollar.
But if there's no danger...
Please, I prefer it this way. Surely, you're not still concerned about the blast?
To be honest about it, no. Not one bit. And I wasn't, at the moment. Yeah, this amazing man simply couldn't do anything wrong. I would have staked my life on it. But by the time I'd driven the long, curving road to the Dortmund Brewery below, had found the place not only deserted, but completely shut down, a funny little hunch began to grow in the back of my head. Even the office building was dark, as far as I could see. With the help of a business card, I slipped the lock on the front door. And then I saw the thin streak of light under the door of JP's private office. I thought I heard something in there. The office was a shambles. Account books and papers scattered all over the place. A couple of cartons, the drawers of the crusty old files were open and for the most part empty. Somebody had been hastily packing and removing all the important papers. But why?
I'm sorry, Johnny.
Oh, what?
Sorry! Oh! And you seemed like such a nice boy.
Act three of yours truly, Johnny Dollar, in a moment.
Anyone who has survived the rigors of basic training is familiar with a great variety of milk that is dished out periodically in the armed forces. Now, there's frozen milk, frozen concentrate, and good old powdered milk. But sometimes, supplying wholesome, fresh, real milk has been a problem when servicemen have been stationed in out-of-the-way places. The United States Air Force came across that problem some time ago in the island of Terceira in the Azores, those Portuguese islands that dot an eastern portion of the Atlantic Ocean. The airbase there was considered powdered milk country for a long time. Although cattle have played an important role in the economy of the island of Terceira, the herd was badly inbred and milk production was very low. Modern milk processing was not a part of the picture. And with the help of Portuguese veterinarians, the men in the United States Air Force unit worked out a free breeding service by using a small herd of milk cows acquired in England, and the cattle there at Terceira improved. Then, a complete pasteurizing, homogenizing, sterilizing, bottling refrigeration plant was flown in from the United States. As soon as this activity got underway, milk production began to climb steadily, and thirsty Air Force men and civilians were soon buying and drinking the new fresh milk. When economy of the island began to rise rapidly, the people were happy and grateful. You might say that a little milk of human kindness increased understanding on an island of freedom, the right of all men everywhere.
And now, Act Three of yours truly, Johnny Dollar and the JPD Matter.
When I came to in the office of the Dortmund Brewery, my head fell as though it had been split wide open. The sash weight that had been used on it lay beside me. But why had J.P. struck me down from behind the door where she'd been waiting for me? And why before that had she been hastily packing a lot of business papers, bills and so on to take away? A couple of them still lay under me where I'd fallen. It was several minutes before I found strength enough to roll over and try to push myself to my feet. As I did so, I saw two things. One was a bill she'd overlooked in her haste to get away. A bill from Frank Line Powder Company addressed to her personally. A bill for 21 cases of dynamite and some other explosives. The other was my watch. I'd been out for hours, too many hours. For according to my watch, it was 1:52 a.m., exactly 8 minutes before the tremendous dynamite blast on the cliff above was to be set off. And suddenly I knew where, somehow, by her plan, those thousands of tons of rock would land, and not harmlessly in the river below. And I knew why J.P. had left me here, so I'd be crushed by them. Come on.
Oh, please, come on. Hello. Oh, please, hello.
Operator,
this is emergency.
Yes, sir.
Hey, look now, I'm calling from Dortmund Brewery. It's between...
Yes, I know where it is, sir.
There's a big construction. Carlson Kemper, that's the name.
Well, sir,
up on the cliff above this
sir,
brewery here.
Sir, I'm sorry, but those lines were disconnected late this afternoon.
What? But look, surely there's some way to... Operator.
I'm sorry, sir, but there's no way to ring them.
Oh, no. Oh, I've got to get out of here. Somehow I got to get up there and get it. Oh, no. Oh, please. I got to get in.
I told you.
Don't push that plunger.
I'm sorry.
Don't set off that blast.
That's
no.
That's exactly what I'm going to do right now.
No, you're not. No.
I'm sorry, Mr. Dollar. You have no right to interfere.
You
now stand back.
You hear what I said.
Dollar, put down that gun.
You touch that plunger and so help me, I'll pull this trigger.
Now, wait a minute. Dollar, what's the matter with you? What's happened to you, man?
Oh.
Good heavens, man.
I guess it was just luck that I was still hanging on to that bill for the dynamite that I'd found. I guess it was luck that made Crutchfield grab it when he tried to keep me from falling. Made him look at it carefully by the light of his flashlight. But it was his good sense that kept him from going ahead and setting off that charge. When daylight came, he found the spot on the face of the cliff where J.P. had another charge planted. It was set to go off by concussion from the blast that Crutchfield had set. It would have diverted the rock from Crutchfield's blast to smack dab on top of her little beer factory. Nobody would ever have known who'd really done it. And J.P. would have collected $820,000 insurance for it. Incidentally, when the police caught up with her, which wasn't hard, they also found the book she'd taken from her office. Yeah, J.P. Dortmund was broke. Stony.
Expense account total, including a handful of doctor bills for my aching head and all the incidentals I could think of, $204.80. Yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
Our star will return in just a moment. Our flag now numbers 50 stars, and behind each star, there stands yet another flag representing one of the 50 states. The origin of Hawaii's state flag has been the subject of much debate. It is now believed that it was the work of foreign advisors to King Kamehameha. Legend also has it that it was designed at the request of King Kamehameha by George Beckley, an English sea captain. The flag consists of 8 horizontal and alternating stripes of white, red, and blue, representing the 8 major islands in the chain. Also represented is the British Union Jack, a reminder of Captain Vancouver, who on his voyage around the world in 1794 gave King Kamehameha a British flag and the promise of British protection. The Union Jack is also a reminder of Captain James Cook, who discovered the Hawaiian Islands in 1778. Hawaii's state flag, the flag of the 50th state to enter the Union, was adopted in 1845. Now, here is our star to tell you about next week's story.
Next week, the ideal vacation matter. But believe me, it turns out to be neither ideal nor a vacation. Join us, won't you? Yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
Yours truly, Johnny Dollar, starring Bob Bailey, originates in Hollywood. It is produced and directed by Jack Johnstone, who also wrote tonight's story. Heard in our cast were Eleanor Audley, Gene Bates, G. Stanley Jones, Alan Reed, and Austin Green. Be sure to join us next week, same time and station, for another exciting story of yours truly, Johnny Dollar. This is Dan Cumberly speaking. This is the United States Armed Forces Radio and Television Service.
That's it for this week. We'll be back next week with more old-time radio. I hope you can join us then. Till then, this is Jim Dolan, thanking you for listening.